it's great to be here. The other night I was standing over by the door, and two of those cheerleaders were behind me. But I was, of course, paying attention to what was going on in here. But I couldn't help but notice that one of them said, "Ask her." And the other one said, "You ask her." So this went on until I turned around and they looked at me like deer in headlights. And I walked over to them and I looked at them and they said, "Is this a Christian conference?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "We want to come to your conference next year." Christian conference. And one of them shot back at me, "Is that possible?" Now, I'll tell you what, every one of my evangelistic bones went off. You know how sometimes you want to go, "Is that possible?" Instead you go, "Well, yeah." So anyway, it is good to be here. They may show up next year, so be looking for it. So I was about that age, maybe a little older. I was a freshman at Oregon State and ran into Campus Crusade. Now at that point in my life, I was maybe halfway through as a junior, and I was a half hippie, half sorority woman, environmental activist. Who for comic relief dated cowboys. And sort of a hippie, my friends and I would say things to each other like, "You do your thing, and I'll do my thing." Oh, and if by chance we find each other, it's beautiful. You guys are laughing because you're not nearly as deep as we are. So anyway, I went off to this Campus Crusade conference, and though I'd been raised in a church, I don't remember having ever made a conversion experience. And so all I remember from that weekend was praying and coming to the place in the prayer where I was supposed to follow somebody's lead in praying words, and instead I just remember saying, "God, I really mean it." So I graduated and then went to work for Campus Crusade for a number of years. My first assignment was UCLA. Now I remember it was a bit of a cultural, spiritual whiplash to move from Corvallis to Westwood. And I remember praying four prayers that first few months at UCLA. The first prayer was, "God, my spiritual leadership has obviously made a mistake. So please move in their hearts and influence them to move me back to Ecotopia." Well, that didn't happen. So then I said, "Well, God, maybe you could change these people. Make them more lovable like me." That didn't happen. So then I prayed, "God, it would be okay if I got a disease." Nothing that would hurt or leave a scar. But just something serious enough that I could, leave with dignity intact. Well, that didn't happen. And so then I, as many of you have, came to the point where I said, "Okay, God, it would be okay if you changed me." And I spent the next many years with Campus Crusade, and I had great successes. I saw joy. I saw tragedy. I saw the world. I saw fun. I loved and was loved. I learned about God. And then I came to the year 1993. Now, I bet you've had a year like 1993. It sounds like Kathy has. Maybe your 1993 is the year 2003. And it's tough to be seated here with us this morning. You've got a lot going on. In 1993, I felt as though I was in the wilderness. I was hemmed in. A world that had formerly become, that had formerly been too big for me, or too small for me, just the right size, became too small for me. It was because of my own growth, my own development, because of the chaos that we always live in, to some extent. And to some extent, it was also from, as a result of the behavior of other people. And it seemed like my world became too small all of a sudden, but not really. In 1993, I resigned from Campus Crusade. I experienced a devastating breakup of a life-changing but doomed relationship. And my heart was crushed. I held my old golden retriever as she was put down. My a member of my family faced addiction. We had to do an intervention. My parents threatened divorce, which I had no category for. And then there was a small matter of my actively beginning to come out. 1993 was the year that was for me. We've all had one, or we were in one, right? Now, I had tried to comply with the version of Christianity that I lived in for many years. Keyword, comply. It's true that God changed my heart in many ways because he's faithful. But I had tried to comply with a ministry that said spiritual leadership comes from males. Women can influence, but spiritual leadership is the domain of men. It was a ministry that said emotions and bodies really don't provide much trustworthy information. And then, of course, it said, don't be or do homosexual. I complied with those things. And with every passing day, those expectations fit less and less with reality. And continued compliance with them wasn't nearly enough for my soul, or where I knew God was taking my soul. Go ahead with that first slide. In his wonderful little book, A Grace Disguised, a Whitworth professor named Gerald Sitzer writes this: the quickest way to reach the sun and the light of day is not to run west, chasing after the setting sun, but to head east, plunging into the darkness until coming into the sunrise. Let me read that again. The quickest way to reach the sun and the light of day is not to run west, chasing after the setting sun, but to head east, plunging into the darkness until coming into the sunrise. When you and I are hemmed in by our own development and growth, by the behavior of others, or simply by the chaos that is always a part of our life, we are not victims. We are pilgrims. We are waiting and we are hoping. And the scripture almost always refers to times like this as times in the wilderness or times in the darkness. And every spiritual hero in the scriptures and since has had a time like that. And I'll bet everyone here has had time in the wilderness too. It wasn't as though 1993 was my first visit to the wilderness. If you're like me and many of my wonderful friends and clients through the years, you've noticed some hallmarks of being in the wilderness as a human being. Maybe you forget for a minute about the possibilities and your ability to co-author your life. Maybe you sleep too much or not enough. Maybe you eat too much or not enough. Maybe you isolate. Maybe you pout. Maybe you identify with the Israelites in thinking, well, you know, Egypt wasn't that bad. And then you have a choice. You can find a way to get numb. And that's what I equate with heading into the west, chasing the setting sun. You can use drugs, alcohol, other people, work. The list of human addictions is staggering, isn't it? You can get numb, or you can turn around and allow the feelings and questions to come. You can plunge by faith into the darkness, and you can meet your Creator there. And you can find out about God's faithfulness. And sometimes God will comfort you actively, and He will hold you. And sometimes you will just sit in silence, knowing that God is your companion. And when you finally do come into the sunrise, your sense of God and yourself and of life's possibilities is far more spacious than it's ever been. My story and the meaning I make of it is, by and large, my own choosing. That's how God set things up. The same thing can happen to two people. And one can choose a life-giving meaning, the other one can choose darkness. The most important thing, I think, in God's economy is what I do next. No matter where I've been, it's what I do next. This morning I want to talk about a magnificent Hebrew concept. It's connected and related to our salvation. It's connected to the name of Jesus Christ and the fantastically important work that you and I have to do in our years on the planet. I call it the spaciousness of reconciliation. And in the next few minutes, I want to talk about what it is, what it looks like, what it's not, and what it can look like in your life emotionally, socially, physically, in our relationship with God. By the way, I will be referring to God as He and Him, not because I think God's male, but because I can't get used to not using pronouns. It feels goofy going back and forth. So please know that I believe God is as much a seamstress as a male architect as blah, blah. But just for simplicity's sake, not fuss around with pronouns too much. I used to be able to explain the mystery of the cross far better than it seems like I can now. I'm thinking about writing a book entitled, What I Learned After I Knew It All. If you'd like to contribute a chapter, just see me afterwards. All I know is that because of the cross, the reconciliation between me and God and me and you is an eternal possibility. This morning I want to focus on the spaciousness part, the spaciousness of reconciliation. Would you pray with me for a moment? Our loving God, thank you for drawing us into a relationship with you that is full of freedom, the spaciousness in life, and the possibility of our engaging more and more with you, more and more with each other, more and more with life. And at the same time, to know that 10,000 years from now, our life will be even fuller than it can be here. We invite you to take this morning and teach us about your authentic spaciousness. We pray in your strong name, Jesus. Amen. Okay. Yesha is the word. Yesha. It's the Hebrew verb meaning to make roomy, wide, sufficient, spacious, to help, deliver, rescue, and save. From that verb comes the noun Yeshua, which means salvation. It's the word which the Greeks transliterated Jesus. Thus, in the language of the Old Testament, the very definition of salvation, Yeshua, is to be brought into a spacious place. Psalm 31 is a psalm of David. It's not necessarily connected to any particular event in the life of David, but we can tell that it seems to have been written in, or at least to recall, a time of suffering, a time in which David was hemmed in in the way I've described so far. Good and wisdom. In you, O Lord, I seek refuge. Do not let me ever be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. You are indeed my rock and my fortress. For your name's sake, lead me and guide me. Take me out of the net that is hidden for me, for you, my refuge. You have Yeshua. You have set my feet in a broad place. Other versions translate, you have set my feet in a large place, a safe place, a wide space, a roomy space. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to visit the site of the former Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. And at that time, it was still possible to visit the isolation cells, the solitary confinement cells that were designed for people to stay in for days and months. They were still open to the public, and you could step into them. I remember, and the way they were designed was so that you could not lie down, nor could you sit comfortably. They were the tiniest little closets with a tiny little window on it, door that, of course, would not open. I pulled the door closed behind me as I stepped in, and I placed my hand into the wood under the tiny window where hundreds of desperate hands had worn a smooth, tragic impression. And the tightness of that space took my breath away. And when I pushed the door open again and stepped out, I experienced Yeshua. You and I have found lots of ways to feel hemmed in our lives. In this imperfect world, tyranny comes from many sources, not the least of which is our own choice. Think about a time when you were hemmed in. Maybe it was a time of debt. Maybe it was a time of job loss. Or a time when a relationship that you've been faithful to and tried with all your heart to fulfill a covenant in had fallen apart and you were left with a broken heart. Maybe it was a time of addiction, a time of crisis in your health. Maybe when you found out you were positive. Maybe it was becoming aware that your behavior had injured another person desperately. Maybe it was a time of being in the closet, and maybe it was a time when you came out. Go ahead and show that next one. This is what most of our lives look like in public. Can you tell what this is? It's an actual photograph of an iceberg. Stunning, isn't it?
Yes.
So we all know, conceptually, that icebergs just have maybe 10% of their bulk showing above the waterline. Most of you, and I know I, grew up keeping a lot of things to yourself, while you stayed vigilant about what was going on around you. That can be a hemmed-in place, right? In that place, you just aren't free to expansively engage in life as you really are. Most of you have a charming public version of yourself that you learned and honed during those years, right? That version of you that got so much admiration in your home churches when people loved your decorum and dating members of the opposite sex. That version took lots of control and lots of planning, didn't it? It took up lots and lots and lots of space on our hard drives. And then we started to come out, and we began to notice we had energy for other things. Coming out wasn't easy, but at least we could begin to put less and less time into projecting that invented version of ourselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's a hemmed-in place. For most of us, that invented version of ourselves is a place of secrecy, not privacy. There's a difference between secrecy and privacy. Secrecy is about shame, right? Privacy is about your boundaries. So to the extent you experience secrecy, even now, to the extent that you experience projecting that contrived version of yourself, you are in a hemmed-in place. I've been a therapist long enough now to know that, breakthroughs rarely happen. What's more common is for us to slowly, gently begin to trust. Isha is the sufficient, wide, and free canvas for co-creating our mortal existence. There's a truism I believe in. The more you try to be who you are not, the more you stay the same. The more you try to be who you are not, the more you stay the same, and your life is stuck. For most of 20 years, I had national responsibilities with Campus Crusade. I did not put that in our, I asked Jamie to not put that in the stuff online promoting this conference. When I spoke in New York last year, they used that in their promotional materials, and somebody from my past called and told them that the way I was presenting myself was not true. So I decided not to put Campus Crusade in print. So I have friends at Campus Crusade, and I have appreciation for many of the things that I learned and people in this audience I know have learned to benefit from that ministry. But I stayed until Yesha became irresistible for me. God created me to lead, even though I'm a woman. And I complied with the ministry's notion that only males could do that. And needless to say, I've been closeted and silent about my sexuality. And the price for embracing God's creative stamp on me was too high. For a long time, all I could think about was what I could lose. And I know some here, you're nodding. You understand that. You understood. Then, and probably now for some of you, all that you could lose if you came out. On the night I resigned from Campus Crusade, I had a dream. It was one of those dreams that began in full action. The dream began with me running as fast as I could through the entry hall of a richly appointed castle. And I was running as fast as I could towards the drawbridge as the drawbridge began to rise. And I remember thinking, I need to get to the end of the drawbridge before the drop will kill me. And I ran as fast as I could. I struggled to the end of the drawbridge, landed hard, and I kept going without looking back. And I ran into the surrounding forest, and I woke up. And I remember thinking, there's something about the castle I've just escaped from that was not altogether uncomfortable. In fact, it was familiar, and I knew I was a member of royalty there, and I belonged there. And yet, I couldn't wait to escape. And then I remember laying there and thinking about the passage in Hebrews 11, where it describes the departure of Abraham and his family from their homeland. It says, by an act of faith, Abraham said yes to God's call to travel to an unknown place that would become his home. And when he left, he had no idea where he was going. When I left in February of 1993, I had no idea where I was going. I'm going to talk for a minute about Yesha, what it looks like in the lives of two wonderful characters in the scripture, two of our peers. First is found in 1 Kings 19. Context here is Elijah. He has just mixed it up with Queen Jezebel, who I hear has some new followers. Her behavior. Anyway, she and King Ahab were mixing it up with Elijah, and he was running for his life. So he takes off, he runs 100 miles, and at the end of 100 miles, he gets pretty tired and he stops. First Kings 19, verse 3. Elijah sat down under a solitary broom tree. Okay, he's in a hemmed in place, right? And he asked if he might die. It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and he said, "Get up and eat." And he looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him, and said, "Get up and eat. Otherwise, the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank, and then he went on the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. Horeb is another word for Mount Sinai. It was only a couple hundred miles, probably, from where he was to Mount Sinai. And even as an old guy, he could have covered that in far less than 40 days. So I have a hunch that what the angel of the Lord was sending him to do was to move into the wilderness, into a time of reflection and listening. So then he gets to Mount Sinai, and it says at that place it came to a cave. Literally in Hebrew it says the cave. It's likely, or at least theorized, that this was the cave of Exodus 33, where God appeared to Moses. He spends the night there, and then the word of the Lord comes to him and says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" It reminds me of the question, the first question in the scriptures asked of God to Adam and Eve. Remember that question? It's after they'd eaten of the forbidden fruit and they were hiding. And God came to them, or came to the garden and said, "Where are you?" Not because he didn't know. "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah had an answer that I believe was somewhat reversed. He says, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to destroy it." And God said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." But it was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks into pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, there came the sound of sheer silence. Some versions of the scriptures record this as a still, small voice, or literally the sound of gentle quietness. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" You know what he did? He went right back to his rehearsed answer. "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. The Israelites have forsaken your covenants, thrown down your altars, killed the prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." We'll laugh at this guy, but I have done this. Haven't you? And the Lord tells Elijah, "Okay, here's the deal, buddy. You are not alone. There are 7,000 left in Israel that are your strong allies." I love God's message of his shah to Elijah. It includes at least three big ideas. Number one, take care of your physical and emotional being. God is very interested in that. Number two, there is God's companionship and there are messages in times of silence if you can stand being quiet and if you can listen. And number three, you're not alone. Faithful allies are all around. One of the toughest assignments I give to my clients is in asking them to make time to hang out with themselves. Is that ever hard for you? It's hard for me sometimes. It's a spiritual discipline to sit quietly with God and with your own life, sometimes in the dark, sometimes in the presence of fear and shame and sadness and anger, sometimes in gratitude and confidence and kindness. The biggest transformation in my life in 1993 came when I became a little bit more willing to stop deflecting pain and sadness and to stop deflecting my own hunches and desires. And I began to listen to them in the same way I would listen to a beloved child. This takes time and space. Let me show you the second example of God working Yeshua into the life of one of his people. It's the story of Zacchaeus. In Luke 19, I was in the running for a favorite Sunday school story. Right? I can't help but smile when I read this story. As I do, I invite you to listen for tones of voice and expressions on faces that you think were going on during the course of this little story. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead, climbed a sycamore tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "It's going to be the guest that wanted this, sir." And Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay him back four times as much." And then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save bad guys." Right?
Mm-hmm. The
lost. The lost. When Jesus needed a word to describe the human condition, that's what he picked. Lost. Now some of you have that song going through your heads. Right? Some of you are thinking, Zacchaeus was a real man. If you're the casting director of a movie about Zacchaeus, who do you cast in the role of Zacchaeus?
Danny DeVito!
Anybody here knows Danny DeVito? Would you cast this along? Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through, and a man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead, climbed a tree to see him because he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and say, "He's gone to be the guest of one who's a sinner." And Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions, Lord, I give to the poor. If I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." And Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which was lost." Jesus Christ was so secure in his identity that he could move towards people like Zacchaeus and you and me with their confused motives, their confusing behavior, their confused hearts. He didn't legislate. He didn't control. He didn't seek compliance. He sought lasting change, healing, and growth. Here's God's message of Yeshua to Zacchaeus. Think of two. First is the welcoming spaciousness and reconciliation of Yeshua is available right here, right now. In this moment, and in this moment, and in this moment. And Yeshua will change your behavior via relationship. I've told some of you the story of a niece of mine named Sophie. When Sophie was 5 years old, she was spending the day with my mother, an exceedingly gracious and gentle person. But Sophie was having a rough day. All day long, she bid in timeout. At dinner time, my mother set Sophie's dinner before her, and evidently disappointed with what was being served, Sophie looked at her dinner and began to sing. Damn, 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 damn. My mother did exactly what you're doing. She thought, he's like, I can't laugh. So she got the eye on Sophie's face and said, Sophie, what am I going to do with you? And Sophie said, okay, here comes the line that will melt you. Sophie says, you can hug me. Oh. So my mother did, and guess what? Her behavior got better. Sophie's dead. About what Yeshua is not. In the Christian faith, freedom can be a perilous thing. Right? Talk about what it's not. Many of us grew up in churches where annually the passage from the Sermon on the Mount was preached on narrow is the path. Small is the gate, narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Matthew 7. And we grew up thinking, I can have me or I can have God. The context of that famous passage was Jesus speaking about our behavior in this life of faith. Here's how Eugene Peterson renders it in The Message. Don't look for shortcuts to God. The market is flooded with surefire, easygoing formulas for a successful life that can be practiced in your spare time. Don't fall for that stuff, even though crowds of people do. The way to life, to God, is vigorous and requires total attention. Finding God's spaciousness takes awareness and courage to face reality. To face your pain and to face your amazing possibilities. Yeshua is the opposite of sloppy and inattentive. Yeshua is wild. True wildness is full of life and focus and intention, or you don't survive. And Yeshua is free. True freedom is boundaries. I've been reading Seabiscuit. Haven't seen the movie yet. I want to read a paragraph about the description of Seabiscuit when he came into the hands of his trainer named Smith, who it turns out was a fabulous example of a good shepherd. The grooms were walking around with their faces fixed in permanent winces. Every time they passed Seabiscuit's stall, the horse lunged at them, mouth wide open, ears flat back, eyes in a sinister pinch. He meant business. Heaven help the poor kid who had to go in there and mop the floor and curry the horse. Everyone was wondering what Smith possibly could have been thinking. The horse was a train wreck. He paced in the stall incessantly. He broke into a lather at the side of a saddle. He was 200 pounds underweight and chronically tired. He was so thin, said one observer, that his hips could have been made a passable hat rack. Smith took the colt to the track to stretch his legs, and it was a disaster. Seabiscuit didn't run, he rampaged. When the rider asked him for speed, he slowed down. When he tried to rein him in, the horse bolted, thrashing around like a hooked marlin. Asked to go left, he'd dodge right. Tug right, he'd dart left. The beleaguered rider could do no better than to cling onto the horse for dear life. Smith watched, his eyes following the colt as it careered around the track, running as a moth flies. When Seabiscuit was acquired by Smith, he was neither wild nor free. He was lost. What is Shaw is not. It is not inattentive. It is not undisciplined. It is not unloved. There's a wonderful old Persian proverb that talks about growing into awareness. I'll read it slowly. It takes a little concentration. She who knows not and knows not that she knows not is a fool. Shun her. She who knows not and knows that she knows not is a disciple. Teach her. She who knows and knows not that she knows is a sleeper. Wake her. She who knows and knows that she knows is a leader. Follow her. What I notice about bogus freedom, also known as the way of destruction, is that people almost never like their own company and will do almost anything to avoid it. Have you noticed that? They'll do anything to escape at work, drugs, alcohol, walking into bars, and hopefully never coming out alone. But as much as they like sex, interestingly, they're not very tuned into their bodies. These are the people with ulcers and tight shoulders and hypertension and anxiety and depression. What I notice about true spiritual spaciousness, about living in Yeshua, is that you learn that God's voice to you, as it was to Elijah and Zacchaeus, is full of very present patience and kindness. What's the next picture? This is my niece a few years ago, little Patricia Ellen. There are two of us. We've got this covenant with each other that our behavior will not embarrass the other. She's taught me about being patient with myself and about enjoying my own company and about how to speak with myself. When she was little, we would go out on dates and we would sit on a log and we would, you know, we would watch life go by and we would notice that seagull over there with one leg and how he must be very brave. And I noticed over time that Patty was not very interested in quality time. That is an adult invention. What she wanted was quantity time. She just wanted time to hang out. And she would tell me the important stuff in her life, not on my schedule. And my soul is a little bit like that. Isn't yours? It's not an on-demand kind of deal. When I live in Yeshua, I don't mind hanging out with my soul and speaking to it with all the kindness that I would speak to this little girl. Okay, Yeshua, what I think it can look like in your life. The life we live as followers of Jesus Christ is an ongoing creation. Something to be authored, not just a series of problems to be solved. So listen to the first words of the scriptures. They're about creation. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was formless and void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while the wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness God called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. When I hear this passage, I notice that creation began in the midst of complete chaos. And when creation was over, two things were true. God was very pleased, and there was still chaos. There are still vestiges of disorder in your life, in my life. And there will be until we pass from this time. As people created in the image of our Creator, we each have years on the earth in which to author our life. Yeshua doesn't mean gaining control over chaos and unpredictability. That will never happen. He is choosing to be aware rather than checked out. To author your life, to quietly expect further relationship, meaning, and joy, to expect that. My partner is an emergency vet, and sometimes she will come home after a particularly traumatic surgery, and she said, "I did what I could. I cleaned the wound, I set the bones, I opposed the edges, and now the miracle has to happen." I think of our life spiritually to be that way. You have to invite God to set the bones, to make things clean, to oppose the edges, and then a miracle happens. And that is the freedom I think we live in. We expect that. We expect the miracle to happen. We expect further meaning and further love. In his lovely little book, Learning to Fall, Philip Simmons talks about learning to live his final days in the throes of Lou Gehrig's disease. When you're dying, as I guess we could say we all are, awareness and meaning are not automatic. You have to learn. And he uses the metaphor, if you've ever played sports, someone taught you to fall. Because you're going to fall. And there's value in being able to fall so that you don't create further injury.
Amen.
Right? About half the work I do sometimes in my therapy practice is in helping people not create further injury when they're down.
Right.
So this is what Philip Simmons writes. My balance is not so good these days. Last summer I stumbled and went down hard. I lay stunned for a few moments, face numb, lip bleeding, chest bruised. My six-year-old daughter, Amelia, standing over me asking quite reasonably what I was doing there and whether I was all right. I wish I could have managed an answer such as, listening for hoofbeats. What I was doing was learning to fall. I thought about the Buddhist practice of walking meditation in which one becomes fully mindful of each step placed on the earth. One of the blessings of my current stumbling condition is that I must practice this meditation continually, becoming mindful where once I was heedless. God is interested in everything about you. And everything about us is touched by the resources of his vast, engaging, affectionate, eternal personality. In this moment, this moment, and this moment. Pages. There we go. The Apostle Peter wrote, let those suffering in accordance with God's will entrust themselves to a faithful Creator while continuing to do good. When you and I are in a tough place, we can expect God's creative involvement more than maybe ever. In a funny way, I'm a little nostalgic for 1993 and the wilderness I met with God in extraordinary ways. When I came out that year, began to come out, I had all kinds of responses. My father listened intently, and then he said, what was high school like for you? I loved my dad. My brother, on the other hand, Ron, was furious and hurt. I think I'd shattered an image of some kind, and for the next several years, he refused to allow his children to come and visit Carrie and me, including little Patty. In the years since, Ron and I have done our best to stay kind with each other and to stay in relation and to stay in relationship. Both of us believing, I think, that we would find our way back to each other versus via our response to God's grace. In our own imperfect ways, Ron and I both live in grace and truth, patiently over time, trusting that God's way is Yeshua. For me, it has taken the spaciousness of believing that I am not a victim and he is not a bad guy. This last May, I went down to Florida to the graduation of Little Patty. While I was there, Ron and I went someplace in the car. So we're driving down the street, and Ron says, so we got some nice neighbors. Drive, 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 drive. I said, you do? We do. They're moving. We're going to miss them. Wonderful couple. Not paying attention yet. Yeah, two women, they're sweet. So I had to do that same thing I did with those cheerleaders. Instead of going, well, tell me that. And Ron said, well, they put a gay pride flag out and someone vandalized their property. So stupid. So I went over and helped them clean it up. It's not right. Nice people. So that's that chapter. I thought you and I are going. going to Florida tomorrow to the wedding of Patty's sister. So there'll be more family time. But I'll let you know what the next year is. Needless to say, Yesha works, and I am not a victim, and he's not a bad guy.
Amen.
And we can expect God to continue to work in our lives and in the lives of those that we love and wish we could be closer to. That's the direction of God's healing. In our brief stay on the earth, we have some glorious opportunities. Jesus demonstrated that not just by coming to the earth, but by staying. I want to read in closing a poem for you by the poet Mary Oliver. It poses a question. Now I'll put a copy of this up on my website, if you'd like. My website is seattlecoach.com. Seattlecoach.com. Mary Oliver says, "Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is sitting and eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention. How to fall down into the grass. How to kneel in the grass. How to be idle and blessed. How to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have been doing? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me. What is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Thank you for allowing me to join you in this hour of your wild and precious life. God bless you."